afternoon. It's good to be here. 18 years ago, I came to visit Mabel Miller here at this church, one of the last living people to know Ellen White. It's been a delightful Sabbath with her and her family, her recounting memories. So Paradise Valley is a very appropriate place to reflect on Adventist history. My paper is on the Seventh-day Adventist and the development and formation of a ministerial identity. I have this paper on academia. I published an earlier version of it with ministry. Two actually earlier versions of this paper over the last 10 years have been working on developing this. So, Seventh-day Adventist ministerial identity and ecclesiology are integrally intertwined. Whereas the message, organization, and many other factors have each played a vital role in the development of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the role of the minister has, in comparison, been somewhat overlooked. The two most prominent ministers of early Adventism, Joseph Bates and James White, were both ordained Christian Connection ministers in the 1848 to 1850, helped to formulate the core theological framework of the Seventh-day, what became the Seventh-day Adventist Church. By the time of the formal organization of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in 1863, there were 31 active ministers, but that number rapidly swelled to 276 by 1881. The period from 1863 to 1881 should be considered as the seminal formative period for Seventh-day Adventist ministerial identity. The handful of founding ministers, those who, like James White and Joseph Bates, played a leading role in this initial phase during the 40s and 50s, was followed by a second generation of new recruits, including some ministers who converted. Ministerial identity was closely aligned with Adventist ecclesiology because of the simple fact that early Sabbatarian Adventist men and women felt compelled to proclaim the Adventist message. Such compulsions necessitated a system of organization that mirrored the struggles of the early Christian church. Now, this paper sheds some light on this important aspect of Seventh-day Adventist ecclesiology by examining the development of Seventh-day Adventist ministry from the time the church was founded in 1863 to 1881, which is a somewhat arbitrary year. That does also happen to coincide with the death of James White. During this formative time period, many precedents were set about the nature and the role of the Adventist minister and the relationship of the minister to church members and the financial support of the ministry and even the development of the practice of ordination among early Sabbatarian Adventists. Now let's talk about the ministerial composition and challenges. Of the 51 active Seventh-day Adventist ministers between 1846 and 1863, 14, approximately 27%, were affiliated with the Millerite Revival. Of those who had some sort of denominational affiliation, the largest part, you would expect, were Methodists. 14, or 27%. That was followed, second, by the Baptists. Very closely, shortly behind, there were 10 ministers, or 19%. Other ministers
included two prominent leaders, Joseph Bates and James White. What surprised me in my research is I expected there to be other Christian Connection ministers. I could not find any others. Altogether, early Seventh-day Adventist ministers reflected the wide diversity of socioeconomic and religious backgrounds out of which Adventism was born. During the late 1850s and early 1860s, leaders such as James White faced two challenges. The first came from ministers who claimed to be bona fide Seventh-day Adventist clergy in order to solicit donations from unsuspecting church members. Some of the interesting accounts in the review reflect about how people had been duped. Such individuals were unworthy of the title of minister and were merely scam artists. Several supposed ministers that went about and duped early believers during this time were, in fact, genuine ministers who were self-supporting and depended upon the generosity of believers to help defray their travel expenses. So there were legitimate needs at that time. Now, there's a second challenge, though, and this came from ministers who defected. Thus, Moses Hall, who became a spiritualist, or B.F. Snook and W.H. Brinkerhoff, who formed the Marian Party. Some of these, and then there are still others who did not necessarily defect, people like J.B. Frisbee, who just became discouraged and gave up ministry for a time. Such losses diminished the ranks of Adventist ministers during the 1860s. Now, of course, each situation was problematic in its own way, but once they defected, the typical pattern was to use their sphere of influence to draw others away from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. These problems necessitated that it was a sacred duty, according to James White, for church members to check ministers for their ministerial credentials. Those of you ministers, I hope you're carrying them with you in your pocket. Ministerial identity. Church organization, therefore, played a crucial role in the formation of Seventh-day Adventist ministerial identity. Ministers were credentialed through the local conference. Now, part of the purpose of the local conference was to provide a mechanism for aspiring ministers through which they received a ministerial license. Such an aspiring minister, an aspiring minister would typically be given a set of charts with the expectation that they would go out and raise up a congregation. By 1869, there were sufficient aspiring ministers that this two-tier system was noticeable. After sufficient experience, a young minister received their ministerial credentials in conjunction with a ordination service which recognized their call to gospel ministry. As the church grew, so did the need for ministers. Not a surprise there. During the 1860s, letters published in the Review and Herald frequently contained appeals for ministers to please come, and almost begging to visit these isolated church members. It was not uncommon for believers to go many months and sometimes even years without a visit. When a minister did show up for their monthly or quarterly meeting, these were regional gatherings in which believers came together. And it seems like almost in a very pietistic fashion, from Scotland, you have these gatherings of the holy fairs that you see in other evidences of evangelical scholarship describing. You see described the communion service, and that's where the communion service becomes an integral part of Seventh-day Adventist identity during the same formative time period, with also the foot washing. Such meetings were rich times, and featured the, when they did, when they were fortunate enough to have an Adventist minister, they would come and preach their hearts out all weekend long, and included all kinds of, any administering of church ordinances, a baptismal service, the celebration of the Lord's Supper. By the way, they usually would celebrate Friday night, all day Sabbath, all day Sunday. So most early Adventist baptismal services and communion services happened on Sunday evening. The Lord's Supper, for example, became the Advent ordinance, to use a phrase by James White, that expressed faith in the blood and efficacious blood of Jesus Christ as a memorial of his first Advent as well as his return at the Second Advent. And so this becomes a unique, a distinctive, the Lord's Supper becomes very unique and distinctive within Adventist theology and practice, and is very closely intertwined with ministerial identity. Life was fragile during this early time period. Many ministers succumbed to disease, which only increased the need for more ministerial help. From 1846 to 1863, there were 18 ministers who, by the time of the formation of the denomination in 1863, who were no longer active in the ministry. I did my own survey, going through the Review and Herald, doing sort of spot checking over, I took a year here and there, and close to 80% of the deaths, at least in my surveys, the places where I checked, resulted, the obituaries indicated that people were dying in droves from the dreaded consumption, or what we would call tuberculosis. And this created more problems. Who's going to bury all these church members who are dying? Back to this, the primary work of the Adventist minister was twofold. First of all, is to make sure that local churches function properly, and then secondly, for them to pursue evangelistic objectives. The first was accomplished by making sure that the church was organized at the local church level. As a result, a basic structure was developed, 1863 to 1865. We see this where the spiritual leader of the congregation responsible for leading out in services was the local church elder. Didn't matter how large the church was. If this was the only exception I could find is the Battle Creek Church, where they really went out on a limb and they had two church elders. And then most of the other work was done by a deacon, a single deacon, who would be responsible for the physical welfare of the congregation. And then the third church officer would be a church clerk who took care of finances. So it's sort of a clerk, financial treasurer sort of position, and the official church records. By the way, taking offerings was considered sinful among the early Sabbatarian believers. So the elder, deacon, clerk would come by your house on Sunday morning and knock on the door and made sure that you paid up. It should be noted that unless the church was, during this time, this is the time period in the early 1860s in which the elder and deacon, you see dialogue taking place in the review as to whether they should be ordained or not, and the result was that ordination should only be done for the elder and deacon by an ordained Seventh-day Adventist minister, and must be done, the appointment to that office must be done by a unanimous vote by the local church. No dissenting votes at all, otherwise you would not be eligible. The earliest detailed job description, which I don't have time to really get into, but D.M. Kenwright, we can thank him for our first description of the role and work of a pastor. He was very concerned as he traveled around that pastors just did not know what they were doing, and so he wrote out this very detailed list to make sure that when you went from church to church, you knew exactly what to do. You check the local records, you look for backslidden church members, and you administer any church ordinances. The list is quite detailed and long. You can look it up in my paper if you would like. But basically, it's very clear that it's very specific what a pastor should be doing at the local church level in terms of administration, as well as making sure that evangelism, active evangelism, is being promulgated. And by the way, that all good Adventist ministers should make their church members subscribe to all denominational periodicals before they left. Another function of the Adventist minister was to also look over any church trials, any problems that were going on in the local church. Only an ordained minister should be able to supervise and facilitate any reconciliation that needs to take place. A nominating committee, the pastor, right from the very beginning, the earliest evidence we can find is the nominating committee should be chaired by an ordained Seventh-day Adventist minister. And so when the minister showed up, whenever that was, would be when you would have nominating committee with the pastor leading. And then nominations for church offices must be confirmed by 3/4 of the church. With no significant objections. It was not qualified what that meant. And then those people would serve in their offices. Thus, from 1863, the formation of the Adventist Church, to 1873, that first decade, was ministerial identity was closely connected to both evangelism and the local church. And the primary task of the minister was outreach. Ministers must preach the gospel and hold evangelistic meetings. And this is especially true of young, aspiring Adventist ministers. At the same time, the role of the minister was closely connected to ecclesiology in the life of the local church. As the minister traveled, they were responsible to make sure that order was maintained in the local church. Now let's look at ministerial growth and the development of the Adventist minister. A series of defections by prominent ministers, coupled with the expansion of the Adventist church, accentuated the need for ministers. Both James and Ellen White, from 1869 to 1873, repeatedly called for Adventist young people to prepare themselves for service. This was a significant reason why church leaders supported the educational endeavors of Goodloe Harper Bell as early as 1872 that culminated in the founding of Battle Creek College in 1874, and a close corollary could be found in the Bible lectures in the Review and Herald done by Uriah Smith, these sort of primitive Bible training institutes for a time functioned for training Adventist ministers. These were so popular, by the way, that James White was so excited he urged Uriah Smith to go and travel and have a managing editor of the Review so that he could go out as a senior minister and mentor these young ministers and hold these Bible training institutes. And so therefore you have the nucleus of the first in-ministry program for Adventist ministerial training. By the way, very early on, it's also very important that Adventist ministers be established and rooted and grounded in Adventist belief so that they can explain in an intelligent way what it is that Adventists believe. Anyway, in response to the repeated appeals by church leaders, a new generation of young men and women aspired to the ministry. This wave of new ministers really took off in 1871 when the number of new recruits for the first time exceeded the number of ordained ministers. And the 1870s witnessed two waves of these expansions where people are responding to these calls from James and Ellen White. And it's very interesting to me that there's a lot of discussion over ordination and so on. Ellen White makes some statements calling for more ministers, but then she calls for caution about being careful who we ordain and that we not send too many ministers. And then you see these waves. There's this, for 2-3 years after these statements of caution. And so it's very important that you look at Ellen White's counsels in their context as to what she is trying to describe and say. What I take away from Ellen White, at least, is that Ellen White was less interested in ordination and more interested in the fact that these young people, whoever they were, that they be laborers. And I find that's a very interesting, distinctive term that she uses to describe what an Adventist minister should be. Go out, preach the gospel. You need to be a laborer and not concerned about titles. The rapid expansion of Adventist ministers during the 1870s brought with it new challenges. One such problem was this matter of title. The title of reverend was obviously quickly repudiated. We don't use that in Adventism. James and Ellen White both referred to early clergy as ministers and less frequently sometimes as pastors, but they were, as I just mentioned, more concerned that they be workers or laborers. James White, for example, referred frequently to the role of the minister, but described himself after 1873 as the pastor of the Battle Creek Church, even though he was largely absent from that congregation. I did this study this last year on the revival of 1873. I think it's probably the most significant revival in Adventist history and perhaps eclipses the 1888 General Conference session, but nobody's ever written about it in Adventist history. It's at that revival, James and Ellen White was going to Battle Creek saying we shouldn't start a school, we shouldn't should not send a missionary because the spiritual conditions are so bad in Battle Creek that we need to get out of here. They move out of town and they keep coming back to visit and there's friction, there's conflict going on among church leaders. Uriah Smith resigns, he's just so fed up. And James and Ellen White have this turning point in their lives. I've never seen anyone write about this in Adventist history, but they're out in Colorado having a mountain retreat. And at one point, they both describe it in their diaries and write about this later on as the turning point of their lives, where they rededicated themselves to the Lord. And it's a short time after that, James White receives a letter of rebuke from his wife, very upset about this, that prompts him to rethink and goes to the Lord. And he spends a week basically by himself and recommits himself to the Lord. And then he goes back to Battle Creek. Now, every time up until then, he had been telling them, you need to have revival and reformation. Very interesting. Again and again and again. You guys are not where you should be spiritually. And this time he comes back to Battle Creek. He gets in front of the Battle Creek church, the meeting house, and he confesses. He says, I'm part of the problem. And he goes and visits all these other church leaders and reconciles with them. And so it's a beautiful example of how he leads the church into forward momentum of revival and reformation. He does it through personal confession and just a very beautiful story. And After that, the Battle Creek Church, they all sign a pledge, the scroll. And after that, that's the turning point when James White, after that meeting, after that revival of 1873, that we send our first missionary and we start our first school. Up until then, they said, no, we shouldn't do this. Hold off. And now they say, forward. We need to move forward. And so it's out of revival and reformation that missions and education take place. And they sign a scroll, all the members of Battle Creek. And for many years, I wondered, because I'd read sermons, and he referred to the scroll on the desk before him. And I presume that later burned down when the Battle Creek Tabernacle burned down. But it's there that the members of the church pledge their support to the ministry of James and Ellen White. And that's when he becomes, even though he'd been GC president and everything else, that's when he becomes the pastor of the Battle Creek Church. Very interesting. Earlier problems in the 1860s had resurfaced, and they expand in the 1870s, and the number of clergy at the same time, as I mentioned, is rapidly increasing, and doctrinal challenges and differences also had been coming up, and so Adventist ministers were encouraged in the 1870s to be abreast of these issues, to go and seek training, the Adventist minister should, for example, model the health ministry, the health work, health message, that they can go and train ministers and go back to the as they minister to their churches. From 1875 to 1881, Adventist ministerial identity matured somewhat further, the sort of last phase of this early formative period, as conference leaders, church leaders admonished that all ministers send in regular reports. I don't know about you, I had to send in weekly or monthly reports to my conference office very early on. We have this tradition, sometimes these reports were published in the denominational periodicals, and ministers were admonished to be sure that they had Robert's Rules of Order to make sure that they know they could how to properly administer a committee meeting and alleviate as many problems as possible through these church trials as they described them in appointing church leaders. And if there was no other way that they could get training, get books to read. Very early on, that Adventist ministers needed to be sure to find good books, and the lists of books were published in the Review and Herald to make sure. I have a section on ordination. I don't have time to really get into it, but very early on, there's a debate in the Review. Should ministers who were ordained in the Adventist church be by another church be reordained when they become Seventh-day Adventist ministers? Some chose to be reordained, but in practice, in net effect, most of them were not. They recognized the validity of the ordination from other churches, and so this was done on a case-by-case basis. Ministers who did want to, aspiring young men and women who wanted to become ministers, this is when we start to see the beginnings of a ordination process. Usually it would take from 4 to 6 years. Again, this is a pattern that continues on within Adventism, even up to the present. The earliest ordinations that I could find of an actual ordination service dates to 1872, incidentally, which is the same year that Ellen White, for the very first time, is listed with other ordained ministers as having ministerial credentials. Of the 117 ordinations that I could track down from 1872 to 1881, this is just going page after page through the Review, very painstaking research, there appears to become a very uniform ordination practice that develops. In all of these descriptions, it's clear that the ordination service was a very solemn event, a very sacred event, and that it involved a couple of very basic parts. One was the ordination sermon, where an experienced Adventist minister would give a sermon of encouragement and the importance of being responsible, the sacredness of their office, and that also an element of personal admonition. And then this was followed usually by prayer, most of the time by a different minister, in which they would lay hands on that person, and then after the prayer that there would be a formal charge to the minister that mentioned the right hand of fellowship. Almost every single example mentions this right hand of fellowship, that they were a part of something very significant, recognizing their special role. Concluding observations. James White repeatedly admonished that Seventh-day Adventist ministers should not hover over churches. Ministers seldom remained in one location for more than 2 or 3 years, and more often operated as itinerant ministers who maintained a route of churches. This was because the primary task of the minister was that of evangelism. Both church members and ministers who failed to share their faith became spiritually weak. Church leaders recognized that there had to be a balance in which the minister did have a responsibility for the local welfare of the church, the flock that was entrusted to their care, but neither should the minister do the work of the local church. So therefore, there's this dual focus that develops very early on between supervision, pastoral care, and that of evangelism, a sort of tension, I argue, that characterizes the life of the Seventh-day Adventist minister. The early pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventist Church were furthermore pragmatist. Organization was a matter of necessity, and church leaders accomplished this through. They recognized that there was this need to recognize ministers, that the organization of the church and ministers were integrally intertwined, and one of the ways that they could best do this was to certify the ministers as problems arose and create ministerial credentials and a system through which the local conference would certify, placing the locus of authority for approving ministerial candidates one step beyond the local church. It was far too easy for Seventh-day Adventists to be duped or scammed by ministers who would be scam artists or whatever. As several ministers defected during the 1860s and 70s, there was a surge of young ministers who did receive ministerial licenses, and the ability to share their faith was seen as the litmus test of God's call. With time, church leaders developed more intentional ways to train ministers, all of which were closely tied to Seventh-day Adventist education. The early pioneers of the church believed that such education would only enhance their effectiveness. Such a minister should be set apart to the work of the gospel ministry through ordination, a recognition of God's call that affirmed the sacred role of the minister within Seventh-day Adventist ecclesiology. Thank you.